In a world of extremes, I've been working on this theme for last week and this week with a variety of subtitles, and I might just flash them before your eyes for those of you who have just joined us. This is sort of the turf that we've covered, looking at along a range where there are extremes and trying to find a balance between them. We looked first of all at self-image with these extremes, and then we looked at the shadow side of our personalities, our hidden and revealed selves, and then we looked at feelings and also values, and ended last week with personal power being at one end with powerlessness and omnipotence at the other end. And then this week we began looking at communication, say that communication is a lot more than just talk, see that one extreme was avoidance of communication and the other extreme was abuse. When we looked at the matter of the faith dimension of our lives, we saw overdependence at one end and faithlessness at the other. And yesterday we looked at caring with the extremes of self-sacrifice at one extreme and self-service at the other. So today we come upon the matter of the performance within our lives, and we look at the extremes of sloth at one end and workaholism at the other. Sloth is such a marvelous word. I haven't heard that since catechism days, but I've said other times that it's an onomatopoetic word because it sort of sounds like what it describes. You can never say sloth. You have to say sloth. I need to tell you that the bookstore has some more books in. They went the first 3 days that we were here last week. This one, Joy of Feeling Good, is the book that the series is based on. The series is much expanded over the book. The other one that the bookstore has is Make Friends with Your Shadow. And this is the one that dealt with the second dimension, the hidden revealed aspect of our lives. It's a fascinating subject. The follow-up on that was this one, Your Golden Shadow, but they don't have any more of these. These are all gone, and I don't think they're going to get any more. But they do have this other one, When Going to Pieces Holds You Together. This is a book on grief. Handling the experience of loss. So if you're interested, take a look at them at your leisure. Here, if you are interested in buying, they have them at the bookstore, and if you're interested in me autographing them, I'd be glad to do that for you at any time. Nail me somewhere or at the session on Saturday. I'm off tomorrow. We don't teach tomorrow. But I don't think we'll have time. We have a little autograph party for those of us who were in the village last week, but I don't think we'll have time to do that. So moving on, today we can roll a tape and get this one underway. My name is Bill Miller, and this is the ninth in the series titled Finding Balance in a World of Extremes, titled Super Persons and Slouches. And for benefit of some of you who are here for the first time, let me give you just a minute and a half overview of what the dickens this is all about. What it's about is that through the years of my dealing fairly intimately with people in a counseling or therapeutic relationship, I came to realize that an awful lot of us live very close to, if not in, the extreme of various dimensions or various aspects of life. I picked just these 10. There may be 100 different dimensions of life or experiences of life. But I selected these 10 and focused on what would be the extremes, what they would look like. And most of us will say, that's really not true, Bill, because we are moderate people, you know. And that may be what we think. But very often, whenever tragedy hits us, or a catastrophe, or there's some kind of an intervention, our eyes are opened. We are amazed to see how closely we have lived towards an extreme than we ever thought. And we're just bowled over by how lopsided our lives have been. Jesus told us that he came that we might have life and have it more abundantly. And the word in the Greek is parousos. And the best definition of parousos is a Holden Village ice cream cone. Overflowing. Life overflowing. Super added, like a gasoline that will never quit. And if we are to have the super added life that Jesus says we are to have, we need to find some kind of a balance between these many, many extremes that we live so close to. If we are to experience a whole and complete sense of living, a fulfillment, we need to find more of a balance, more of a mid-path between these extremes. And the one today is one that I'm not surprised that there are so many of you here. One that we look at, and many of us can say, well, what I know right away, I'm going to shake out over on this end. I may not be a slouch, but neither am I anywhere near a super person, I can tell you that. Or we may say, here I am, I'm over here, and I think maybe I'd much rather be somewhere in here. We obviously are going to vary as to where we're going to shake out, ideally for us ourselves. I mean, Susan may be over here somewhere, ideally for her, and Bill may be somewhere over here, ideally for him. I don't know, that's not the point. The point is that we do, in fact, find that there's a lot of stuff to be desired as well as undesirable over here. And a lot of stuff to be desired as well as there is undesirable stuff over in this extreme. We always look, my motto is, we always look for the virtue in vice, so to speak, and always be careful of the vice that resides in virtue. So, today, what are we up against? Where shall we start? With this side? Workaholics, yeah, no. People who use, yes, sir.
Discuss as we go.
Oh, jeez.
One in a night.
One time I got. This is a discuss. What am I going to? Are you going to be around yet Saturday? Thank you. This is a discuss as we go course. This is not one where everybody sits quietly until the leader says at the end, now are there any questions or any observations? No. We will. Just move it back and forth in discussion as we go along. So please feel free to raise your hand, make your comment, ask your question, make your criticism, make your witness, whatever. I've forgotten to say that at the beginning 8 times out of 9. Yesterday was the one day that I remembered. And there it is, it's red again, right across the top of page 1 in red ink. This is a discuss as we go course. Okay. People who, those of us who are obsessed with achievement. Obsessed is a powerful word, but I don't hesitate to use it. You may want to say, yeah, but Bill, obsession moves into the range of pathology, and we're not pathological. Bull. Careful. Overachievers, the super ambitious who are independent. What is interesting here is that the obsessed with achievement and the overachievers hook right into the very first dimension that we talked about, self-image. A lot of us who grew up in less than desirable milieu, environments, homes, if you will, spend the bulk of our lives trying to overcompensate, not trying to compensate, but we end up overcompensating for that bum self-image that we started our lives in. And I have seen this in my own life, and I'll tell you something in my story a little later on, but I've seen it in the lives of many, many of my students that I have worked with over the years, and certainly in the lives of a lot of people with whom I have counseled, that we somehow are not able, and we have to continually blow the whistle on ourselves to say, hey, you don't have to prove yourself any longer. to the world that you are more than just a kid from the slums or whatever, or a kid from a busted up family, or a kid whose mother was a whore or whatever, or whose father was a drunk or whatever. And so oftentimes, well, I'll just tip my hand and show you my cards right now, that an awful lot of these people are these people at heart. Just as an awful lot of people who come on with big egos as brainbusters are pretty wobbly underneath. The go-for-broke type of person. These are the ones who oftentimes will suffer emotional or physical breakdowns in their lives. Not always. And again, there are always notable exceptions. I know some workaholics who are quite healthy. Their family situation isn't all that swift, but they themselves are okay. And then all the way down at the other extreme, the other caricature, people who are just plain lazy, who will just kind of make it through the day. Be okay about them. Don't get yourself into a tizzy about anything. The slothful, who have no desire whatsoever. The unambitious, and they're mostly dependent people, because they have no sense of direction. And they are following the path of least resistance. They are afraid of trying for fear of failing. Now, I deliberately did that slowdown in pace and pitch because there's a sort of freneticism, a freneticness about this side, and a sort of playing, how would this be? Playing, 78, old 78 record at 33 1/3. What we do, see, is we take this and we temper it with this. And we take this and we temper that with this. We pull them together. We don't worship or adore one and say the other is a devil to be avoided. We find a way to bring those two together and thus bring about a balance. Saturday. The last two of the series are somewhat interrelated in that they both deal essentially with what we shall do with our lives, how we shall use God's gift of life and all the dimensions of it, how we put to use the abilities, the talents, the skills that God has gifted us with. And today we're talking about the development of a style along this continuum of performance, this range, this spectrum, stretching from slothful slouches all the way over here to frenetic overachievers. And tomorrow we're under the title, which I just really love myself, and that's my own egotism coming through, under the title, Galoshes, Umbrellas, and Motorcycle Helmets. We're going to look at the adventure of taking risks, or choosing not to take risks, in living out the excitement of this abundant life, seeing how actually we can live out our life at any point of a spectrum that ranges from everlastingly playing it safe all the way down to the extreme of foolishness and foolhardiness and irresponsibility. But that's Saturday. So today I want to suggest to you that the healthy midpoint between these two extremes is a critter that I call the the imperfect achiever. For me, in my head, that's pulling these two extremes together and finding a balance between them in the concept of whatever this conjures up in your head. And it may not conjure up in your head what it conjures up in mine, and so I understand that. But for me, the imperfect achiever is the balance. I'm biased, of course, because I like that title. But it does seem to encapsulate the balance point. What we do, you see, is we use, as an achiever, we use as much of our potential, our God-given potential, as we can possibly manage over the span of our life, knowing all the time that it's going to be imperfect. That it cannot be perfect simply because of the givenness of our sinful condition in this aspect of life. It can't be otherwise. And if we're able to accept that, while we're in the process of moving ahead with righteous ambition, then we become the imperfect achiever. What we do is we realize and accept the capabilities that are within us, and we experience the fullness of our talents and our abilities and our potentials that are common to all of us people, but that are particular and peculiar to us. Rarely do people take the time to do that, to sit down and do kind of a scorecard on what peculiarly we have been blessed with in terms of skills and abilities. What is so marvelous around here is to see it lived out. People doing this, people doing that, people doing another thing. Having an opportunity, maybe even to discover an unknown skill or talent or ability. And we do this without falling into the trap of workaholism, perfectionism, and or compulsiveness. The extremes are really detrimental to our sense of wholeness and our sense of completeness. In other words, we are never, ever really going to know the abundant life if we shake out in or very close to either one of the extremes. We simply can't. Because there's too much stress. There's much too much stress over here. And if we shake that over on the slothful end, we get caught up very often in situational depression, or even worse than that, stuff that will indeed impede us in ever living out the potential that God has in God's good sense given to us. And so the bulk of the time that we have today, I want to use in trying to answer the question, how. How can we go about finding our balance and becoming an imperfect achiever? But let me pause before I launch into these, because I've got a handful, I think seven if I remember, seven suggestions for us to do this, to get this off. But let me see if there's anything that you want to comment on before we move into that. Anything about the overview of it? Yes.
Do values play a role in which one you are?
Beg your pardon?
Do values play a role in which one you are?
Oh, sure do.
Do they?
Yeah. Values are foundational. They're really bedrock to everything we build in our lives. And they keep moving around. They need to keep moving around. Some of them are fixed. Essentially, the foundation of our faith dimension needs to be fixed. It does not change. But the other dimensions of our value system really keep moving, keep growing and changing with us as we grow and change. Yes?
I have not attended all your sessions this week, but I'm wondering if you have or are going to touch on the need for extreme and giving examples of such people as Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, several characters in history, Thoreau, that did go to extremes.
Yeah.
And it was,
yeah.
And they made their mark in history because
true.
Of the fact that they did go to extremes. Are you going to deal with that?
No. No, because... No, and seriously, because I want to deal with us.
Uh-huh.
What you say is true. And there are always notable exceptions, and I've tried to say that along the line, too.
And many people that, you know, that we never read about.
That's right.
That also helped change the course of history.
That's true. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, and I respect your point, but we're not going to do it here, essentially because I want the time that we have, you know, to be concrete and practical for us. Okay.
But wouldn't that...
Yes.
Along with that, I agree with your comment that a lot of us, I don't think, realize how far to one extreme or the other we might really be. How do you recognize it? I mean, realization and getting to know who you really are and really where you sort out in that spectrum is the starting point for finding a middle ground.
Yeah. I'm going to sound like I'm hawking my wares because I was saying yesterday that in a lot of this you really need professional help to do it. I'm going to say that again today, but most of the time in the feeling of discomfort, which occurs to us probably every other day, if we take the time to analyze what our discomfort is, oftentimes we can begin, if we have eyes to see, and if we're willing to see, we can begin to be our own therapist. The second thing is the feedback that we can get from people who know us well, people who see us in a wide variety of experiences of life and situations. They can help us. But again, I'm not kidding whenever I say to you, we have to want to hear this. Because if you come to me and say, Bill, you know, one of the things that I observe about you is that you have a very, very strong tendency to do so-and-so. I'm going to say, oh, really? Well, thank you very much. And you know what you can do with that information. But I mean that. That's where we are, and that is why. Whenever the realization comes and we realize that we've lived so lopsidedly, people say, they use the word amazed. I've said this before. I was amazed to realize how much denial I was in, how blind I was, how much I rationalized, da-da-da-da-da. So, I think in some of my suggestions, I'll have a little bit of an answer to your question about that. Yes.
Would the terms leader and follower be on either side, like perhaps the super persons tend to be more the leaders and the slouches, I mean, in the most extreme form, would be the follower, a dependent follower, and then the middle might be where you do a little bit of both, realizing it either a comfort or a discomfort, but the ability to cross over and recognize. Are these people generally always the leaders?
Generally speaking, although more often than not, they're very individualistic. And they don't need a following. Yeah. Just they're leader and the following, and they're everything. They're the general, the colonel, the lieutenants, the sergeants, and the corporals and the privates. But generally speaking, yes, if you wanted to look at it in that way, it's possible to have this kind of person as a leader simply by virtue of office or position or family or whatever. And that's catastrophic whenever that happens.
Because it's also a way to get out of the most work.
That's right. Sometimes
you can be directive.
Sometimes you work in a setting where the leader is one of these and you just go nuts. And if you can't do anything about overthrowing the leader, it's misery. Yes?
In your response to this gentleman's question,
yes,
saying that we're not going to deal with people who are out on the extremes making contributions, does that mean that the imperfect achiever, it's an assumption that the imperfect achiever can't make a significant contribution?
Not at all. Not at all. No, I say I respect those persons who are just absolute over in this column, who have made great contributions.
Okay, well,
I'm not going to talk about them because that consumes time.
Yes.
And we have a limited amount of time, and I want to use the time that we have to be very practical with this group as to how we might become this. I mean, we could have a seminar on, you know, great people of history and do that. That would be very informative and helpful, certainly. But we're not going to do it here. That's all I'm saying, yeah.
Okay.
Can we move on, or do you have something yet?
Quickly, in the same vein, you think, I'm thinking of people that I know have, who have chosen to simplify their lives. However, other people look at them as slothful, lazy, and ambitious. And I think that applies to a number of young people that I've met here in Holden who have made a determined effort to change their lives. But there are others, including close relatives, who are
Sure. Yeah, that's a good observation.
A point that really must be made that you, maybe these people are fearful of trying some things, but they're not fearful of trying something else that the rest of us are probably uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And it is definitely
this is a very, very relative thing. There's no question about that. And that's why I say we're not going to have one precise point here where everybody ought to be in order to be healthy. That's not it at all. We're going to have a range here of what the imperfect achiever looks like. First, the first suggestion that I have as to how to go about bringing these opposites together and finding a sense of balance or a midpoint has to do with my old theme of self-esteem. Establish your self-esteem. Positive self-esteem. Self-esteem means self-valuation. How shall I see myself? In what sense shall I respect myself? How shall I accept myself? And with what measure of self-love, healthy self-love, shall I live? This is key to this. Self-confidence, the power of positive expectation. The power of positive expectation comes out of a positive self-image. And people who indeed, in a healthy sense, love themselves have an edge over people who do not, for whatever reason, love themselves or envision themselves as less than, in fact, what they are. Now, this is not superficial stuff, mind you. This is not the power of positive thinking, that if I just say to myself, well, Bill, you really are a person of worth and value, and I say that 25 times a day or 25 times in the morning and so on and so on. No. That doesn't cut it. That may work for a spell, but I pretty soon get tired of saying that. I have to get down to my spiritual root, because that is the only place that my self-worth really can be built, on the fact that I am a creation of God, a loved person of God, that I have worth and value that no one, no situation, no substance, nothing can ever take away, no matter what. And that if Good Friday and Easter have any significance or any value whatsoever, that proves that I am a person of worth and value. Everything else in my life, all of my acting out, all of my using of God's gifts, enhance that, yes. But I start with that. That is what gives me this self-esteem, that I can gratefully say, I love myself. And that will allow me, as I said yesterday, then to love other people. But I need that. I need that sense that healthy self-esteem that can establish me here somewhere in this midpoint, so that I don't go off in some wild egomania saying, I'm here, I'm God, and God is down there. Hi, down there, God. Or that puts me somewhere over here saying, I am just nothing. Low self-esteem can push us into either extreme, and that may be puzzling, so let me try to explain that to you. Obviously, low self-esteem can push us down into the realm of the slouch, because I will say, I have no talents, I have no abilities, I have no qualities that people like. I can't do anything, there's really no point in trying, it's futile. But it can also push us up to the opposite extreme, into the super person realm, and cause us to reside there and miss the balance. I thought long and hard about pulling in my own personal story, and I decided to do it because I think it fits very well. Not that I'm going to give you a whole autobiographical spiel, but just to heighten this, that I had the experience of growing up in severe poverty. I was orphaned when I was a boy. My father died when I was 8. My mother died a year and a half later. My stepmother, who was my aunt, my mother's sister, and her husband reared me. And we were extremely poor. We lived in the slums of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I was ashamed. That was the word. I was ashamed of where I lived. I became really a juvenile delinquent. I was very intelligent, very bright, very active in the church, but on the other hand, also wildly acting out my early adolescence and mid-adolescence in petty theft and gang, running with gangs and drinking a lot. I did not know it at the time, but I didn't like me. I was so ashamed that I wouldn't even tell people when they asked me where I lived. I wouldn't say I lived in Esplin because that was a dead giveaway down on the Ohio River next to McKee's Rocks. I would say I just lived down over the hill a little bit from Sheridan. Now, Sheridan was an acceptable community, you see. I didn't have much clothing of my own. Most of my clothing was given to me by people in the church who had kids who had grown out of the clothes. And so most of the time, as a young man growing very rapidly, none of my clothes fit. My sleeves would creep up and my trousers would creep up. You could say, well, what could you do about it, though? I guess I couldn't do anything at all, but that's neither here nor there. The fact of the matter is that I was impressed with myself as having an undesirable self. Now, I look back over my life, and I can honestly say, without any kind of boasting, that I have achieved an awful lot. And when shall I ever get to the point, however, of saying to myself, you don't have to prove yourself anymore, Bill. You really don't have to prove yourself. You don't have to write another book. You don't have to take on another job. You don't have to take on another position or whatever. I don't know. What I've been blessed with is the ability to have some of this insight that I brought about, gave me. But I don't know if I will ever really be out from under that compulsion. I don't think with me it's an obsession anymore. It certainly is a compulsion to achieve and accomplish, so that with every achievement and accomplishment I can say to the world, hey, I'm not that poor little piece of crap from Esplin. I'm a worthwhile person. Now, I told you earlier, in my experience of dealing with people, especially the students, the hundreds of students that I've dealt with over the years, I see that as something that those of us who come out of those kinds of roots, that's why I say this poor self-image stuff can easily cause you to reside here, but I'm suggesting it can also push us over into this. So that no matter how you cut it, the poor self-image is not going to help us. It's not going to be an aid at all in finding that sense of balance and bringing those opposites together. A healthy midpoint is for us to believe that God is for us, that God loves us, that God is not out somehow to do us in. And then knowing that, to move on to believing in ourselves. Now, people get a little twitchy with me about that, and that's okay. And I like to quarrel with people about that. I had a dream one time. I haven't had very many significant, or as Jung calls them, big dreams. But every big dream that I've had was a really big one. And this one came when, shortly after Marilyn and I were married, and I was in the seminary, and I was working long hours because she was the only one in the family employed, and she was earning a rousing $2,800 a year teaching high school kids over in Grove City, Ohio, outside of Columbus. And I really didn't know. I thought, oh boy, how am I going to make it? Because, see, I'm still under the pressure. I'm still under the compulsion to go straight A in the seminary. I mean, there's no question about that. you get a B, and oh, I got one, I hope you don't see this as boasting. I'm not trying to do that at all. I got one B in graduate school, and to this day, I could wring that man's neck. And to this day, I still say it was a personality issue. I mean, that why should I not confess that to you? That's a fact. That's the way, that's the power of the thing. So the dream, in the dream, I experience that I'm carrying a sack over my shoulder, and it's very, very heavy. I have no idea what's in the sack or where I'm going or anything other than the fact that I'm carrying this sack, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to carry it much longer. It's a doggone heavy. And all of a sudden, I see Marilyn's dad, my father-in-law, who always, really, when the very first time I met him, he wasn't that old, but he had white hair and struck me as an elderly gentleman. And so that's the thing that strikes me in the dream. Seeing this old man, whom I see coming towards me and whom I immediately assume is going to help me carry the load, or he's going to take it from me, one or the other. And so as he gets closer to me in the dream, the better I feel, but when he gets to me, he just stops short and looks at me and says, "You can make it." And that's the end of the dream. Now, in my own imagery, you see, the wise old man, a very archetypal symbol in dreams, is within me. Maybe this is the Spirit of God. I like to think that it is, symbolized in my father-in-law, who bears the imagery of the wise old man. And this voice within me is saying, "You can make it." And I chose, mind you, I chose to believe that. And I did. And I made it very well. And I say, we trust in God, yes. When we were back the other day on the whole dimension of faith, talking about over-dependence at one extreme and faithlessness at the other, and I said that we have that balance between trusting in God and trusting ourselves. We need them both. If I don't have my trust and my faith in God, I don't believe that I'm going to experience this dimension of the imperfect achiever or the balance between any set of extremes in my life. Once I have that, then I move beyond that to believing in myself and going from there. Is there anything that you want to... Oh, yeah.
Two questions. Did you say that there is a direct correlation between the poor and low self-esteem? I mean, is that pretty common?
Not necessarily. Although I would say that the vast majority of people who come out of poverty, severe poverty, have a very difficult time having a high self-esteem. That's been my experience, anyway. I don't want to make absolutes, you know, mm-hmm. but...
And then secondly, if self-esteem is more or less established when we're quite young, mm-hmm. through our childhood and for sure during our adolescence, mm-hmm. then how likely is that to ever to be changed dramatically? Maybe it can be shifted some, but can it really be changed?
Yeah, I don't want to hawk my wares, but I'm going to. If you get a chance to get hold of Golden Shadow, there are a lot of case histories in there of people with dramatic turns around. It takes time, takes a lot of patience. It takes the ability and the skill of another person or persons to be with that person. I'll just digress very briefly and say, the thing that you don't do is to say to the person, "Oh, you don't have to have a poor image of yourself." Parents are sometimes doing that with kids. Kids growing up in even the most loving household can develop really bum self-images. And you who are parents may know that. Maybe your kid comes home sometime and says, "Oh, Mommy, I am the ugliest girl in the class." You want to say, "No, you're not. You're a beautiful child." Don't do that. Don't do that, because a statement like that is a refutation. It is to say, "Kid, you are wrong. I know better, and I'm going to tell you what the right answer to this is." Oh, you say, come on now, Bill, you're pushing things, aren't you? No, I'm not. I'm very serious about this. Ultimately, you're going to say that, but don't be too eager to give out the goodies. Move in with empathy, first of all, and say, oh, you're really feeling bum, aren't you? What's going on? Well, I don't know, and then they'll get into it. Move in with the person. That's what we do professionally in treatment centers. We don't say, ah, you don't have to think you're this or you're that. Obviously, you're not. Boy, that will get you far. Don't quarrel with me about this bitter business of refutation either. That's exactly what it is. Look at it for what it is. Don't gloss it over. Don't varnish it or whitewash it. Know of a fact that you are refuting what that kid is saying. And that kid may not respond to that refutation overtly, but she won't forget it. She will say, oh, Mom doesn't really know what I'm saying. She doesn't hear what I'm saying, or Dad doesn't hear what I'm saying.
Which brings up another question. How much weight does the family have in establishing and supporting a self-esteem when they reach adolescence?
How much weight does it have?
Yeah. Does the family have in comparison to the peer groups?
In comparison to the peer group? Interestingly enough, when we had the teen forum the other night, the teens told us that in certain areas, peer pressure is really very strong, but the influence of home and family, of mom and dad, is likewise very, very strong. When I said when peer pressure is strong, it's in pretty overt things like smoking pot or drinking or wild carousing, those sorts of things. Do not at all underestimate the power and the magnitude of the power of parental support. I tell you from my experience, and I worked in adolescent psychiatry for years, from my point of view, if there had been parental support, we wouldn't have nearly the patient population that we had. I never, in all of my years, now this is an absolute, in my years of experience in working in adolescent psychiatry as a chaplain, I never dealt with a kid who came out of a healthy home situation. Never. Not one out of I don't know how many thousand. It was either, again, right in the extremes. I hadn't thought about that until now, but either a kind of home or a kind of home. That's the best way.
This is a little off the subject, but this idea of reputation, do you think that when children show fear about something like fear, normal fears of a child, lightning, thunder, monsters in the closet, that you should say, there's no monster in there, don't be afraid of that?
Cuddle them up and hold them close and say, we're going to make it. Don't worry about the factual data. No, don't worry about that. Just get close and say, oh, we'll make it. Yeah, we'll be safe together.
Okay.
Yeah. Let me move on.
Child's perception is their reality. You have to respect them.
Sure. That's the way they see it. That's why I say, you know, whenever the youngster says, I'm the ugliest kid in the class, even though you know that that's not true, that's the way at that moment the kid sees it. And if you say, that's not the way it is, then you've blown it. Now you don't. I got to say it because sure enough, somebody will say, well, what do you do? Say, yeah, you're right, kid. You are the ugliest kid in the class. No. Second ugliest. No. Oh, my. All right, let me move on. I have a need to get through a couple more. I told you I had seven, and we're only going to make a couple because we're running out of time. Identify your direction. This is a powerful suggestion to bring those opposites together. I just would love to know how many of you have ever sat down, taken the time in your life to sit down and deliberately decide on some specific goals for yourself. And wrote them out and did the hard, arduous work in life planning that if you've ever gone to a life planning seminar, you have to do. Do you want to? No, I'm not going to ask you to show hands. That is, let me remember the saying that my colleague of many years, teacher, used to tell them in Cokato, Minnesota, Cokato High School. She used to say to them, to get anywhere, you must strike out for somewhere, or you'll end up nowhere. Think about that. To get anywhere, you have to strike out for somewhere, or you'll end up nowhere. And the one that I grew up with, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. Those are old saws of some sort or other, but I think they make an awful lot of sense. Many of us get into kind of a frenetic frenzy over here on this manic side because we don't really know where we're going. A lot of people that I have dealt with want to make as much money as they can, as quickly as they can, doing as little as they possibly can. Not really knowing much more than just that, and I'm not sure that's a very concrete goal. A lot of people end up wandering around over there in kind of a no person's land because I don't know where I'm going. What do you want to do? I'm not sure. I don't go into anything. I think I cruise by. What is it that we want to accomplish? When we were talking about values last week, I gave the group 10 specific questions that can be used to determine what your value system is. And one of the questions is, what is the purpose of life? What do you believe is the point of your life? Write it out. The reason I'm kind of wandering around here is dot, dot, dot. Have we ever done that? I don't know. Do we know where we want to go? Do we know what it is that we want to get to? Many people do not. And that turns out to be the reason why so many people do not know the parasos, the Holden Village ice cream cone, the overflowing abundance of life, the joy of living your life out. Establish goals. Allow plenty of time to do this. If you're interested at all in becoming the imperfect achiever, allow yourself some time to sit down and list your strengths and your abilities. List your special personal skills that you have, that every one of us has. None of us gets totally left out. I don't buy that. I've had people sit down and say to me, there's nothing I can do. And by the time we had spent a couple of hours together, they had a page full of stuff that they could do. So don't kid yourself in saying, I don't really have any special skills. List the undeveloped or underdeveloped skills that you have. Stuff that you've got rattling around in the back of your head that you know you might have developed. That's what this one's about. That's what this one is about. Subtitled, Discovering and Fulfilling Your Undeveloped Self. It is absolutely fantastic what we have and never touch. We say, oh yeah, people are always telling us we only tap into, 2 or 3% of our ability, and then we move on from that. We like to say that in kind of a, I don't know, like I know a certain fact about life statement, but we don't do anything with it. Does anybody say, in the light of that, I will sit down and look into myself and see what undeveloped and underdeveloped skills and talents and abilities I do have that will help me in establishing where I want to go with this thing called my life. And then generate goals out of those things and list goals out of your personal and your relational and your social wants. Oh boy, you say you are really laying a lot of homework on us, Miller. That's right. That's right. And maybe that's one of the reasons why so many of us live in the extremes, because we never take the time to pause and see just where in the devil we are and where in the dickens we're going. When you've done that, then you've got... What time do we have to quit? 6:05. Okay. Once you've done that, then you have to be very realistic and say, okay, now what can upset the apple cart? What are the inhibitors or the deterrents? And you list them. You have to be realistic. You know, maybe I want to do this and my husband is going to say, what? Or my wife is going to say, we haven't got the money to do that. Then develop plans to cope with the potential inhibitors or deterrents. Figure out how can we, and you do this realistically. If other people are involved, you have to negotiate. You have to work it out together. But that doesn't mean that it can't be done. It's more work. If time were no question, if money were no question, we'd all be home free. So let's get realistic. It's not for most of us, and so we have to work at it. But here's the real clincher. Specify points of measurement along the way. And you can measure, and I'm here to tell you, you can measure the success of any goal. And the reason why I say I'm here to say that is because I fought that in GAS. G-A-S. You know what GAS is? Well, you know what GAS is, yeah. But G-A-S, Goal Attainment Scaling. G-A-S, Goal Attainment Scaling. That was that lousy Jim Anderson thing. Anyway, I fought that tooth and nail. How are you going to determine whether a person successfully achieves the goal of becoming more sensitive to another person in an interpersonal encounter? Well, I'm here to tell you that you can do it. If you say, my goal is for my husband and me to experience a greater sense of affection in our lives, how are you going to measure that? You're going to say, well, I think it's gotten better or I think it's gotten worse. No, no, no. You look for concrete measurement. Like, and this is going to sound weird, I know, but that's okay. Like 8 out of 10 times that we go out, I will come home feeling really good about the time that we spent together. You want to measure whether you're coming closer? That's how you do it. But whatever you do, include that. Find a way to measure it along the way so that you know whether you are moving towards your goal or not. How are you going to know that? Some people can go on forever and ever without making any movement and not even know that they haven't made any movement. My third suggestion is be realistic in all of this and recognize that you have limitations. We're not unlimited. We're not omnipotent. Watch out for these old saws like, where there's a will, there's a way. And practice makes perfect. Now, yeah, there's a lot of positive truth, and there's a lot of motivation to those. But I'm going to tell you something. I'm a downhill skier, and I love to ski. I dearly love to ski. And I would dearly love to jump. I'm just excited to watch jumpers. And I have a lot of will to jump. And I'm willing to practice and practice. But I also don't have any cartilage left in this right knee. Consequently, for me to be a ski jumper is not in the cards. Oh, it could be, but you know, I'd probably walk around with a cane for the rest of my life. And so we need to be realistic. We need to know what our limitations are as we list these goals. And that's a very, very speculative kind of thing. Very, when we're talking about relativity in these things, it's all very relative. The bottom line is, shall we be honest with ourselves or shall we pull the wool over our eyes? And if we vow and promise to ourselves that I'm not going to kid myself, that, and if we've got somebody else in cahoots with us in doing some of the goal planning, that will help too. Before there's one more, before I give you a chance to come in again, practice visualization. Some of you know what visualization is, don't you? It's a dimension of meditation that is really very, very powerful. And I don't want to scare you off with the word meditation if you think, you know, you got to get into some yoga position or whatever, or look like a little Buddha. No, actually, meditation is one of the oldest dimensions of Christian experience that simply got lost somewhere along the way. Everyone knows where. But simply to place myself into a quiet setting where I can focus my attention inward, usually on my breathing, and you can find books that give you the technique of doing this. But the point of it is that whenever I'm this focused in upon myself, I can begin to visualize whatever it is that I want to go for, whatever my goal is, whatever the change might be that I want to effect in my life. I think a good illustration, for instance, is for the super person developing a goal of relaxing herself or himself in the midst of something that presses patience, like a traffic jam. And what we do in the visualization process is to make the image in our mind's eye of what we want to accomplish as sharp and as clear as we possibly can. That I would see myself being relaxed, whatever that might be for me, and that I would choose words, very specific words, that would enhance that image. In other words, what I'm suggesting is that we try to make that vision in our mind's eye as brilliant and as clear as we possibly can, so that we can leave the meditative stance and begin to live it up. What we do is we act then as though we had already achieved the goal. I didn't realize, I'll share again with you some of my own personal stuff, I didn't realize that I had done this for many years of my life. I didn't know about visualization as a kid. But I could do that. And I guess that's not too unusual for people who grow up in undesirable settings, to kind of close your eyes and dream about how it might be. And it works. It is a powerful support, a powerful help. And we don't hesitate either, those of us who are Christian people, we don't hesitate to call upon the Spirit of God through prayer and say, help me. Help me move in the direction that I have now decided I need to go, that I want to go. Whenever I'm tempted to slide off the road on this side or that side, help me to blow the whistle on myself and stay and say, hey, no, we're going this way. We're going this way. Help me to stay somewhere in here. And let's slide over into this side and say, oh, I couldn't really do that. Or over this side saying, I'm going to do it. Well, let's see. I've got a couple more, but we've got a couple minutes before we have to quit. Let me see what questions or observations you might have on the turf that we've covered so far.
Okay.
Yeah. A couple more, real quickly. Yeah, just let me identify what they are. The fifth one is avoid procrastination. Boy, isn't this a good afternoon? You say, boy, am I glad I came to this one. Do you know really that the procrastination is another thing you're gonna think I'm hung up on poor self-image, and maybe I am. But procrastination comes out of poor self-image. We really say to ourselves, I don't think I could really do it, so I'll put it off. There's again a direct concrete tie-in with not having a positive self-image. The sixth one is accept failure. And I guess I can kind of sneak by that one because we're going to talk a lot about that tomorrow. But for today, let me simply say that failure has gotten such a terrible press in the United States of America that it sort of develops an 11th commandment, thou shalt not fail. And that's tragic. in this whole process, because that means you can never be an imperfect achiever then, if you cannot fail. People who suffer the fear of failure are locked, really locked in over here. Because if you are afraid of failing, you'll never take the chance of trying, whatever it is. Well, that's again an absolute never. You should say never, never say never. But it's such a profound dimension of this. Failure will tell us what our limits are. Now, I don't have to go and do some ski jumping to know that I'm limited and I can't do that. I just do a couple hikes up to Heart Lake and I know I'm limited. But I do have to work with little children and screw up to know that I'm limited in my ability in helping people as far as little bitty kids are concerned. I don't know, I'm not sure I know what it is, but I'm not effective in working with little children. And so anytime I'm involved with a family where there are little children, I choose to refer them to another counselor or therapist because I don't do well. Failure has shown me that that's not your bag, Bill, and that's okay. I don't expect to be able to cover all the turf, but failure can be a very positive thing. It can show us what our limitations are. The high jumper, interestingly enough, determines his or her ability by failure. You know, you keep jumping until you knock the thing off and you don't make it anymore. Well, you say, the person failed. That's true. But she also achieved. The thing that strikes me, too, I'm not that much of a sports fan, but people in the world of professional sports are always failing. You know, they're dropping the ball, they're throwing the pass too short, they're running out of bounds, dropping an easy fly out in center field, they're striking out. I grew up in Pittsburgh with the Pittsburgh Pirates, and my hero was Ralph Kiner. And if any of you are old baseball buffs, you know that Ralph Kiner was a home run king. Ralph Kiner also struck out more than anybody else on the Pittsburgh Pirates team. Take a look back in history sometime and you'll see that, well, look at the Babe, that people who knock the ball out of the park more than anybody else also strike out more than anybody else. So maybe on that note, we ought to say it's not so bad after all. But let me thank you for your interaction and your kind attention and sincerely invite you, if you're here yet, Saturday, to the last one in this, which I think, for me at least, is very exciting, this whole business of taking risks or forever, everlastingly playing it safe. There is the craziness, of course, of riding your motorcycle without a helmet and crashing and splitting your head open. That's one end. But the other end is wearing your galoshes and carrying an umbrella even when the sun is shining, just to play it safe. So enjoy your bread, and we'll see you. Thank you.
Oh yeah, we should take any chairs that you brought in.